Thank you so much, Shira. Wonderful to have the opportunity to do a little learning with you today. And special extra points for everyone who has shared their video. Wonderful to see so many smiling faces with us today. Hope everyone has received the source sheet or has access to the source sheet in the chat. If not, not to worry. When something important comes up, I'll be sure to share the screen. Just to put things in a wider context before jumping into today's topic, the guiding question that I'd like to kind of keep in the back of our heads as we progress through these sessions is what it is that made and makes the Shulchan Aruch such an enduring code of Jewish law, if not the preeminent code of Jewish law in our lives. Last week, we looked at the magnum opus of Rabbi Yosef Karo, which he wrote over the course of many years from 1522 to about 1550, and then went about publishing it during the 1550s. And we talked about what made the Beis Yosef such a revolutionary work, such an important work, such an extraordinary work. And today I want to turn our attention to the Shulchan Aruch itself. Next week, we'll talk about the Ramah of Moshe Isserles and his role in these questions. And then 2 weeks from today, in our final session, we'll try to tie things together and provide some clarity and make some kind of argument about what it is that makes the Shulchan Aruch endure. So the question that that I want to begin with and use as a kind of frame for our discussion today is, why would the author of the Beis Yosef write a book like the Shulchan Aruch following his magnum opus? As we talked about extensively last week, there really was nothing like the Beis Yosef. It was the life work of Rabbi Yosef Karo, again published in the 1550s, and in 1565, right? We don't know exactly how old Rabbi Yosef Karo was, but let's say well into his 70s, if not older. In 1565, Rabbi Yosef Karo decides to publish this book that we know as the Shulchan Aruch, and the question is why. Just to put it in historical context, the 16th century was an age of legal codification. So there's something in the air about people writing codes of law, not just of Jewish law. But I want to think about that that larger question. And to that larger question, I'd like to append a couple of smaller questions, which I hope will contribute to the making of a larger argument about what this book is and why the author would have gone about writing it in the first place. The smaller questions that I want to think about are why the book was published in Venice. Okay, the book is written, if you remember last week, we said that in the 1530s, Rabbi Yosef Karo emigrated to Palestine and lived for the rest of his life in Safed, in the holy city of Tzfat. The book of the Shulchan Aruch was written in Tzfat. There was not a printing press at the time in Tzfat, but there were printing presses in Europe and in the Ottoman Empire. Why, of all places, does Rabbi Yosef Karo decide to have the book printed in Venice? And then as a kind of footnote, if you remember last week, in the introduction to the Beis Yosef, the author provides a list of his primary sources, 32 sources that that he says that he'll quote and will inform his decision making, and that he'll reference over the course of his commentary in the Beis Yosef. And at the very end of that list, he says, "I'm also going to use the Zohar." Okay. The Zohar is a mystical work, is a Kabbalistic work. It's not the work that we would think of at the top of our mind when we think about Jewish law or halacha. So I also want to just park in the back of your minds the question of why is it that the Shulchan Aruch, that the author of the Beis Yosef, and as we'll see, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, why is it Rabbi Yosef Karo would include a mystical work like the Zohar in a halachic work like the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, so with that in mind, I want to study with you the introduction, the Hakdama to Rabbi Yosef Karo's Shulchan Aruch. Okay, it's much shorter and much more succinct than the elaborate introduction that we looked at last time. The introduction to the Beis Yosef, the Hakdama to the Shulchan Aruch is relatively short. And it already kind of indicates that the author is working on the assumption that his readers are familiar with his magnum opus, with his earlier work, and much larger work, the Beis Yosef. So with that in mind, I'm going to share with you on the screen the introduction to the Shulchan Aruch, the Hakdama to Rabbi Yosef Karo's Shulchan Aruch, source number one on your source sheet. Okay, we'll jump in from the second paragraph. He begins, of course, by thanking Hashem for allowing him to produce this this text. And now he tells us in the second paragraph a little bit about why he went ahead and produced this work in the first place. Ra'isi ani bilibi. Kitov lilkot shoshnei sviri amrav bederach kitzara velashon tzach vekolel. I decided that it would be a good idea to aggregate, to collect all of the various pieces of my larger work into something more condensed, into something more succinct, in a language that was conclusive and decisive. Yafev and Aim are, let's say, eloquent and free flowing. Why did I do this? Leman tiyat taras Hashem tamima shkura b'fi kol ish Yisrael. The idea was that the words of Hashem, and what he really means is the words of his commentary in the Beis Yosef, that the words of Hashem would be on the tip of the tongues of every Jewish person. Ki kasher yishalu letalmid chacham devar halacha, lo yigam gemba. The idea is that when someone asks a question to a scholar with respect to a particular halacha, you know, what do I do when I forget Yalev Yavo? The scholar should be able to answer without having to fumble, without having to stumble. Ela yomar l'chachma achosi at. Okay, so based on the pasuk, that lechachma achosi at kishem shebarur lo shachoso asur lo kach yeh barur lo kol din shishal alav halacha lemasa. He says it should be clear as day, just as someone knows the status of one's own sister, so too one should know the entirety of the corpus of Jewish law with that level of precision and with that level of confidence, so that if anyone should ask, the answers will be top of mind. Bioso shagur b'fiv sefer zeh habanui l'tal bios. The idea is that this text and its contents should be right at one's fingertips. Tel shakol ponimbo lechalko lechalakim shloshim. And he says, I've divided it up. The Shulchan Aruch is the commentary to the Beis Yosef is the commentary to the Torah, and the same way that the Torah is segregated into sections covering the four major areas of Jewish law, he says, I've created 30 sections of my book, the Shulchan Aruch, l'lmod bo b'chol yom chelek. And the idea, I'm not sure how many people in history actually accomplished this feat, but he says the idea is that you could learn one of the 30 sections each day. The Talmud 30 sections, so that a person could study one section each day. You'll cover the entirety of the corpus of Jewish law over the course of 1 month, and then the next month begins, and you could read it all again. Okay, what a stunning project, and what a stunning expectation. He says, and I'll just tell you one more thing. Zos ve'od, one more thing. Hatalmidim haktanim, yegu tamid v'yishanenu l'shono al peh. The second purpose, the second goal, I had when I wrote this book. It wasn't just meant to be for Talmidei Chacham. It wasn't just meant to be for scholars. It was meant to be for children, so that they will have the sharpness of this knowledge on their fingertips, at the tips of their tongues. This concept in the rabbinic imagination, girsa diyankusa, it's been borne out with lots of studies over the past 100 years. The stuff that kids learn when they're young, they retain for a long, long time. So he says, I want to make this part of the curriculum of the cheder, so that kids come out of the cheder knowing the entirety of the Jewish corpus of halacha. If I can put the entirety of the corpus of Jewish law into the hands and hearts and minds of young people, and they learn it and absorb it when they're kids, they'll have it forever. V'gam ki yaskinu lo yasuru mimenu, they'll never forget it. V'hamaskilim yazhiru kizor harakia baniach lahem atzavam yagia kapam yishashu nafsham behagosam b'sefer zeh asher kalu machmadim halacha psuka ve'ein omer ve'ein dvarim. Everyone should have access to this text. And he says, just in closing, one last paragraph, I'd let you know why I named the book what I named it. V'karasi shem sefer zeh shulchan aruch, which literally means a prepared table, a set table. Why did I call it a set table? Ki bo yimtza ha-hogeh kol minin, because someone who studies it, someone who reads it, will find all kinds of courses. Mita'amim aruchim bakol bishmurim. Okay, everything is here. Every flavor is set before you. Sidurim uberurim, clear, concise, and organized. Umuftach ani b'chesed elyon ki el yidei sefer zet simala aretz das as Hashem haktanim im gedolim. I have every confidence. I have every confidence with God's help that through the publication of this sefer, the world will become full of people, both adults and children, who know God's law. Tamid im mevin chacham charashim ben avon lachash. V'chen efrosh kapi al Hashem, efrosh kapi al Hashem, yazreini al devar kavod shemo. Lios mimatzdikei harabim, v'yazkeni achel begamor lios misugar b'hilchaso, mitukan imkubal b'tofi afeh. Thanks to Hashem that I was able to accomplish this. V'nei matchil asos kasher ya'ati v'Hashem, yeh bezri. Hashem should help me accomplish my goal and execute this this vision. Okay. So over the course of time, even though if you would have stopped Rav Yosef Karo on the street and said, what's your greatest contribution to the Jewish people? What's your magnum opus? He almost surely would have said the Beis Yosef. In the course of time, the Shulchan Aruch has outshone and outstripped the Beis Yosef. It's printed more often, it's cited more regularly, it's studied in yeshivos, it's studied by lay people. It has much more cachet than the much larger and much more expansive Beis Yosef. It became his most, the Shulchan Aruch became his most important work. So we've said a lot about it, but what is it, how does it work, and what made it so popular? Okay, so I just almost at random chose a couple of examples to demonstrate how the Shulchan Aruch differs from the Tur and the Beis Yosef. Okay, so again, we're between Hanukkah and Purim. I picked one example from Hanukkah and one from Purim. Let's study them together. And this, I hope, will give a flavor and a sense, even though I know many of you have studied the Shulchan Aruch, a flavor and a sense specifically for how the Shulchan Aruch differs from the Beis Yosef and from the Tur. Okay, so source number two on your source sheet. So the Tur wants to know, what does one do on the Friday night of Hanukkah? Hanukkah is 8 days. There's always going to be a Shabbos Hanukkah. Sometimes there's more than one Shabbos Hanukkah. And you just have to know how to navigate your various responsibilities. There's obviously an obligation to light Shabbos candles. There's an obligation to light Hanukkah candles. So which do you do first? Which do you do when? The Torah says, I'll tell you what to do. Source number two. Kasav Behag, Ner Shel Shabbos Vishel Chanukah, Yadlik Shel Chanukah Bereishah. So he quotes the earlier source, the Baal Halachos Gedolos, who says that on Friday night, or let's say Friday afternoon, this is happening before Shabbos begins. So you have in front of you an obligation to light a Shabbos candle and to light a Chanukah candle. What do you do? Yadlik Shel Chanukah Bereishah, you light the Chanukah candles first. Why? Dimadlik Shel Shabbos Bereishah, Itzer Lei, Ladluke Shel Chanukah. If you would light the Shabbos candle first, well, then it would be Shabbos, and then you wouldn't be able to light the Chanukah candle, to hakable l'Shabbos, because you've accepted Shabbos. And once you've accepted Shabbos, you can't light candles anymore. So by default, there's no choice. You have to light Chanukah candles first. That's the position of the Bahag. Now, the tour continues, and he says, V'atosvos kasvu, but the Tosvos have a different position, and what do they write? She'ena kabbalah tuluya b'hadlaka. That, in fact, Shabbos is beginning. When do you accept Shabbos? He says the time that you accept Shabbos, that's not dependent on your lighting candles. You could just as well light Shabbos candles first. Shabbos is when you make Shabbos. Again, if the sundown happens, it's Shabbos. But provided that that hasn't happened yet, you can make Shabbos a little early, as long as after Plag Mincha. So if you light candles and you say that it's Shabbos in your mind, then it is. But if you light candles and say, I still have other things to do, it's not Shabbos yet. It's not Shabbos yet. So Tosfos are not bothered by the fact that lighting Shabbos candles will somehow impair your ability to light Hanukkah candles. You could go ahead and light Shabbos candles first and then go ahead and light Hanukkah candles. That's totally fine. So if you're a regular God-fearing Jew who just wants to know what to do on Friday afternoon of Shabbos Chanukah, Erev Shabbos Chanukah, you pick up the tour and you're kind of left wondering. Well, the Bahag makes a point and Tosfos have a point, and now I want to know what I should do. And there's just no conclusion in the tour. He just tells you there's two opinions. I'm like, thank you, but now what do I do? So, as you know, as you would anticipate, the Beis Yosef has a lot to say about this, because the Beis Yosef, as again you would anticipate, provides an entire research project on this question. You think only the Bahag and the Tur in the last 500 years had opinions about this question? Lots of great people had opinions about this question, and I'm going to tell you what all of them said. We don't have to go through the entirety of source number three, but just quickly to scan it. The Beis Yosef commenting on this is Kasuv Baal Halachos Gedolos Ner Shel Shabbos Ner Shel Chanukah Yadlik Shel Chanukah Bereishah, quotes the tour. He says, let me tell you what the Ran says. Ran, Beperek Mamadlikin Kasuv Sheharamban Hikshel Divrei Baal Halachos Gedolos. The Ran quoted the Ramban, who had a problem with the Bahag's position. But the Ran gave an answer to the Ramban's question. The Hemi Divrei Baal Halachos Gedolos and defended him. V'chen Nira Midivrei HaMordechai Sham. And it seemed like the Mordechai agreed with him. But the Rosh of a Rosh Kasav Sham Demashbev Gemara Shekabal HaShabbos Ein Itzuli Badlach Kasaner. But it seemed like the Rosh lined up with Tosvos, the Kasav Rabbein Yerucham Shekain Ikar. And there was a Rabbein Yerucham that seemed to agree. And on and on and on. So again, it's Friday afternoon. The sun is setting. The clock is ticking. I'm just trying to figure out, which candle do I light first? Help me out. The tour gave me two opinions. I don't know which one I should follow. And now I'm in the Beis Yosef and I'm in a research article. And it's fascinating and it's a work of great virtuosity. But where's the conclusion? If I keep reading all the way at the end of the paragraph, Ule Inyan Masa, and by the way, as a practical matter, the Beis Yosef finally gives you a conclusion, nearly demandic shell. You should light Chanukah candles. Okay. If you open up the Shulchan Aruch, so there's no two opinions. There's no Bahag and Machlokes with Tosfos. There's no essay. There's no research article. There's, I didn't even count, 10 words. The Erev Shabbos, source number 4, Madliki Ner Chanukah Tchila V'Achakach Ner. I'm not sure you could have figured out or devised a more succinct way to tell your reader what to do on Erev Shabbos. On Friday afternoon, you light your Chanukah candle, and then you light your Shabbos candle, period, full stop, next halacha. So we didn't have a book like this. We didn't have a book that gave me the decision, the conclusion, the final answer based on, right? And he could only do this, and we'll talk more about this in a few minutes, because he had the Beis Yosef. He wasn't telling you, I don't want you to know the ins and outs, and I don't want you to know, I want you to know it all. But presuming that you've studied it all, and now you just need a quick reference, or you need a quick reference, and at some point you'll study more in depth, I'm giving you a book with just the decisions, the conclusions, so that you can observe halacha the way it should be observed, halacha l'ma'aseh. A second example, and again, Purim is coming up, so it's good to know these halachos. What are the brachos on the Megillah? I open up a tour, and I get the following. Hakore Megillah Mevarach Lifaneha Gimel Brachos. Before I read the Megillah, I'm supposed to say three brachos. What are the three brachos before the reading of the Megillah? Al Mikra Megillah v'Shechiyanu v'Sha'asanisim. Very nice. Okay, those are my three brachos. V'Chasav Rabbeinu Tam, and then the Torah continues. V'Chasav Rabbeinu Tam, Sha'af b'yom tzarech levarach Shechiyanu sh'ikar mitzvas kriyasa b'yom. Now, normally, we don't do this, right? So if you make a Shechiyanu the first time you do a mitzvah, so the next time you do that mitzvah, you don't make a Shechiyanu the next time, like on Hanukkah. You make it on the first night, but not on the second night. So on Purim, though, you make a bracha on Purim night before reading the Megillah. You say Shechiyanu. And Rabbeinu Tam, Sha'af b'yom tzarech levarach Shechiyanu. Wow, when you read the Megillah in the morning, the second time, you say the Shechiyanu again. Why? Because the main reading is actually not the nighttime reading. The main reading is actually the reading during the day. So say Shechiyanu during the day too. The Rambam Zalkasev, She'ein b'varach Shechiyanu b'yom. But the Rambam says, no, only one Shechiyanu, and that's at night. V'adoni avi zal, the Torah says, my father, my dad, the Rosh, he's kim l'das Rabbeinu Tam. He agreed with Rabbeinu Tam that really you should say a bracha of Shechiyanu a second time during the day, even though you said it last night. So, once again, fascinating. I now know the position of Rabbeinu Tam and the Rambam and the Rosh. Well, what do I do? And the Beis Yosef, as you would expect, quotes the Gemaras and any other Shittos and tells you the ins and outs. But what do I do practically? So along comes the Shulchan Aruch in source number 7. Akaras and Megillah Mevarach Lefaneha Gimel Brachos. There's three brachos that you need to say before you read the Megillah. Al Mikra Megillah V'Sha'asanim Shechiyanu Uvayom, and in the daytime, Einu Chozer Mevarach Shechiyanu. Just know that that bracha of Shechiyanu is reserved for the nighttime reading. During the day, no bracha of Shechiyanu. Yeah, I think most of us do say a Shechiyanu when we read the Megillah during the day. That's the Ashkenazic practice. We'll talk about the Ramah next week. But if you're the Shulchan Aruch, clear, concise, and there's no room for ambiguity. Okay. With this in mind, I want to switch gears for a moment and turn our attention to the question of the Shulchan Aruch's relationship to the Zohar. I mentioned at the beginning that it should strike us at the very least as a bit odd that in a book of Jewish law, the author would give so much pride of place to a book of mysticism, to the book of the Zohar. It's not unusual for the Shulchan Aruch to cite the Zohar, and sometimes to even decide halacha on the basis of the Zohar. And I want to wonder aloud why that would be. So let's just see this in action in one specific example. In the interest of time, I'll just share a couple of highlights, but you can see this in your source sheets beginning in sources 8, 9, and 10. Okay. as a general matter, we put on tefillin on weekdays, but we don't put tefillin on Shabbos and Yom Tov. The tefillin is called an os, we need an os during weekdays, but on Shabbos and Yom Tov, those days are themselves referred to as an os, as a sign between Hashem and the Jewish people, obviating the need for the wearing of tefillin on Shabbos or holidays. So that's all clear and unambiguous. The Torah in source number 8 mentions the following. He says there is one place of ambiguity, and that's Chalosh HaMoed. Chol HaMoed, the intermediate days between the Yontif of Pesach, first days and last days, that's the intermediate days of Pesach Chol HaMoed, and between Sukkot and Shmini Atzeres, intermediate days Chol HaMoed. Chalosh HaMoed yesh nistakim bo im uzman tefillin umanich naso b'lo bracha. It's a little bit debatable. So what you do is put them on without a bracha. My father, the Rush, would actually say a bracha. So according to the tour, it's pretty clear that you do put them on. The only thing he was in doubt about was whether or not to say a bracha. So now the Beis Yosef, once again, a whole article about this complex topic. And just follow me, if you will, in the bold in source 9. The Beis Yosef writes the following. He says, he says that the general practice now amongst Sfaradim is we don't wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. V'shamati shemikodem hayu manichon osam b'Chol HaMoed kidivir Arash. I heard that some time ago they did wear them in accordance with the position of the Rush. B'achar kach matzu shekasav Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai b'mamar echad she'asor lahanicham b'chol hamoed v'al kein nimne'u milahaniach b'chol hamoed. But what happened was, and he's just sort of reporting on the history of this practice. He says, you know, a couple hundred years ago, based on the teaching of the Rush, Sfaradim would put on tefillin on chol hamoed. But then what came to their attention was the position of Rav Shimon bar Yochai in the Zohar, who happens to write in one passage that it is prohibited to wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. And so they stopped. The Sfaradim stopped putting on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. And my uncle, Rav Yitzchak Karo, wrote similarly, based on the Zohar, we don't wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. And then at the end of this long essay, Rabbi Yosef Karo writes the following. In the bold, at the end of source number 9, Umi'achar shebet Talmud adidan lo nisbar din zeh beferush. Mi arev libo lageshes la'avur bekum aseh al divar Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai ha'mafliq kol kach be'isur hanachasam. He says, look, at the end of the day, the Talmud is silent. The Gemara doesn't say one way or the other what to do about wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed. There just is no Gemara that tells us what we should do. Definitive. And so in the absence of a Talmudic statement about how to conduct ourselves on Chol HaMoed, we defer to the Zohar. We defer to the position of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Who are we to contradict his position? He seemed to be so stringent. He seemed to be so strident in voicing his opposition to wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed. So this becomes an operative principle in the Beis Yosef, in the Shulchan Aruch. If the Talmud is silent and the Zohar has a position on a particular halachic matter, we will defer to the halachic position of the Zohar, and that will be decisive. And so it is. If you open up the Shulchan Aruch in source number 10, this is exactly what he says. Shabbos v'yom tov asr linech tefillin neshem atzmam os. We don't wear tefillin on Shabbos and Yom Tov. In source number 10, Sif Beis b'chol hamoed gam kem asr linech tefillin mi'atam hazeh bi'atzmo shiyemei chol hamoed gam hu'em os. Same thing applies on chol hamoed. Not because the Gemara said it. And not because the Rambam said it, and not because the Rush said it, but because the Zohar said it. And the Shulchan Aruch paskins in accordance with the Zohar. Okay, and I want to just flag for a second, we'll come back to it in a moment, the question of why so much authority would be vested in a mystical text when it comes to answering halachic questions. Let me pause to share a secondary source in a beautiful essay by Isidore Twersky called Shulchan Aruch, Enduring Code of Jewish Law. Professor Twersky writes the following. You should, if you don't already know the work of Professor Twersky, so he's one of the most important Jewish historians of the 20th century, and he was the teacher of a whole generation of leading historians in this generation, also the son-in-law of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Professor Twersky wrote the following, and I'll just share one quick excerpt to try to drive home this this point. The second line in source 11, he says, the Shulchan Aruch gives the concrete idea, but omits what Dilfi called Erlebnis, the experiential component. In the Shulchan Aruch, the halacha manifests itself as the regula iuris, a rule of life characterized by stability, regularity, and fixedness, making known to people the way they are to go and the practices they are to follow. These specific visible practices are not coordinated with invisible meaning or unspecified experience. Okay. This is what he calls an apodictic text. It's a how-to book. It's a guidebook. It's concise to the point of eliminating everything other than the conclusion. Even in the Tur, which is meant to be a guidebook, is position number one, is position number two, none of that. No reason, no rhyme, no rationale. If you're interested, that's in my book called The Beis Yosef. It's all there. And, right, I did a lot of work to compile and to synthesize all the earlier positions in my book, The Shulchan Aruch. I'm not interested in giving you the background or the debate about the issue. I'm interested in giving you the conclusion of the issue. I'll just say one kind of parenthetical remark in conjunction with this point about the Shulchan Aruch being uber practical. If you just zoom out and you think about other codes of Jewish law, so the Rambam wrote a code of Jewish law, which is meant to be entirely practical, but a significant portion of it ends up being theoretical. Why? Because the Rambam covers the entirety of Jewish time, which is to say, he writes halacha not only for this moment, but for the moment when the temple will be rebuilt. So if you pull up a Rambam off your shelf, there's a Hilchos Korbanos, and you'll have to know what to do about Tumah and Tahara in the temple. The Rambam has a lot to say about all of those topics. If you pull a Shulchan Aruch off the shelf, there's no Hilchos Korbanos. The Shulchan Aruch is meant as a code of law for this moment and not the moment when the temple is rebuilt. So it's specific to the lived Jewish experience in the exile prior to the rebuilding of the temple, unlike the Rambam, which is meant to be a code for all times, including after the temple is rebuilt. Okay. So with this in mind, I want to begin to make an argument, and it's not my own. Professor Tashma and others have made this case, but I want to share with you this argument that begins to tie together some of the questions that we've asked over the course of this session. Okay. Remember, we started by asking why the Beis Yosef, why the author of the Beis Yosef would, after writing this magnum opus, write a code of just Jewish law, just the conclusions, just the decisions. And I think you already have a sense of the answer to that question. Why would the author of the Shulchan Aruch have printed the thing in Venice? And why include the Zohar in a why include a mystical work in a work of Jewish law? So Professor Tashma and others have made the case that it was the goal of Rabbi Yosef Karo to write a work which would be accepted not just by the Jewish community of Safed, and not even by the Jewish community of Palestine in the 16th century. His goal was to write a work that would be the authoritative work of Jewish law for the entirety of the Jewish people, which is quite a stunning undertaking. So how do you achieve something like that? And how do you gain entree and access into communities that are not your own? Now, by this point in his life, Rabbi Yosef Karo is a very senior person, and he's established as the Gadol Hador. But he's established as the Gadol Hador in the Sephardic community. So he doesn't know, I'm an Ashkenazic Jew, I'm an Italian Jew, I'm a Greek Jew. He doesn't necessarily speak for me. We can recognize his authority for his community, but I can read his book saying he defers to Sephardic authority. What about me? How is my ancestry? How's my practice? How's my Mesorah going to be represented in a book written by this Sephardic Talmud Chacham living in Safed? And so, part of what happens in the unfolding story of the Shulchan Aruch is an explicit or implicit appeal to Jewish communities that are not his own. So if you think about it as concentric circles and radiating outward from there, for Sephardim, it's the clearest. And we already started to look at this last time. If you remember, the three giants, the three pillars that form the halachic process, or the central piece of the halachic process for the Beis Yosef, and in turn for the Shulchan Aruch, are the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush. Two out of three of those pillars are, in fact, Sephardic. And so you already know that the balance of power and the balance of authority that we're going to see and read about in this text is going to be informed by the Sephardic giants of the Sephardic Mesorah, right? So there's an automatic intrinsic appeal to any Sephardic reader of this text. That being said, Rabbi Yosef Karo knew that he needed to appeal to Ashkenazim as well. And so he also called upon Ashkenazic poskim to fill in gaps or report on minhagim that were uncontested. It was as if he was tipping his hat to Ashkenazic communities and saying to them, I'm also a book for you. My book is also authoritative for your community. I haven't neglected you. I haven't forgotten you. We'll talk about some opposition to this next week when we talk about the Rama and the books that he wrote on behalf of and in representation of Ashkenazic Jewry. But in principle, in the mind and in the heart of Rabbi Yosef Karo, he was tipping his hat and appealing to potential Ashkenazic readers of his text. And now I'll just say something on a wide angle lens and zoom back in. In 2023, we tend to think of a bifurcated Jewish world as like Ashkenazim and there's Sephardim. And it might be like Lithuanian Ashkenazim, Polish Ashkenazim, and there might be Moroccan Sephardim and Syrian Sephardim, Ashkenazim and Sephardim. But the world is and was not so neatly divided. In this time, and again, we're talking about the second half of the 16th century, there are Jews of Italy who are not Ashkenazic and not Sephardic. There are Jews of Turkey and of Greece who have their own age-old minhagim and traditions that would never identify as Ashkenazic or Sephardic. And Professor Tashma argues that it was for this very reason that Rabbi Yosef Karo was so quick to include the Zohar in his pantheon, in the constellation of potentially authoritative sources of the halachic process. Okay. For the Jews of Italy, Turkey, and Greece, Rabbi Yosef Karo included the Zohar. Those tended to be centers of emerging Kabbalah, particularly in Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, Safed, but also, excuse me, in Greece. The Zohar had achieved halachic status unprecedented in the world, and so by including the Zohar, Rabbi Yosef Karo was also implicitly saying to these communities, my book speaks to you, and my book can be authoritative for you as well. Okay. We could say the following: the inclusion of the Zohar and other Kabbalistic texts attempted not only to encompass the full range of ritual practice, but also to unite the theological and legal orbits that Rabbi Yosef Karo inhabited. Remember, he's living in a center of mysticism in Safed in the 16th century. The last unanswered question with which I began was, why print the thing in Venice? Now, it's a little bit of a straw man, in the sense that Venice was probably among the closest places where a Hebrew book could be printed. Hebrew printing did come slowly to Safed, but not until a couple decades later. And so one could argue that it was a question of convenience, but there's probably something more. Venice at the time was the most prominent and prestigious center of Jewish print in the world, and a book printed in Venice would have had the widest possible circulation and distribution of all Jewish books, depending on where they were printed. A book printed in Venice would have been distributed much more widely. And this just kind of speaks to and amplifies the sense that it was Rabbi Yosef Karo's intention to be a decisive and authoritative halachic code, not just for his community, but for the entirety of world Jewry. Okay? Which, again, to think of the 16th century and, you know, how far away one location was from another, and the difficulty of travel and the expense of travel, you know, how many Jews ever saw, right, a Jew who came from another, right, to be thinking about a global Jewish community and unifying a global Jewish community around a singular halachic text in the 16th century is a stunning thing to imagine. Let me just conclude with a couple final points and a couple final sources, and then we'll leave some time for questions. Let me share with you, this is from a very recent book by Roni Weinstein, just published in 2020, called Jewish Modern Law and Legalism in a Global Age, The Case of Rabbi Joseph Karo. Roni Weinstein makes the following points. The title of Maran befittingly reflected the self-construction of Rabbi Karo. We haven't talked about this, but Rabbi Yosef Karo was known and is known in posterity as Maran, which is quite a special appellation. It's not just a Morenu or Rabbeinu, but Maran. We'll talk more about it actually in 2 weeks, but listen to this formulation. Okay, the title of Maran befittingly reflected the self-construction of Rabbi Karo, as revealed in his diary and in his practical activities as a scholar and judge. He considered himself, and this is the point I want to focus on, he considered himself and his double magnum opus the culmination of the entire Jewish erudition in the legal halachic domain. His work offers a stage of encounter for and between all present and past scholars, as we talked about last week. This encounter is not to be taken symbolically as if encounter, but as a very real one, since these discussions are held in Heavenly School, where all the dead scholars of the past, especially Karo himself, participate in the same debate during moments of mystical eruption, along with contemporary runs. It's all of the history of the Jewish halachic process rolled into a single book. If you just go back for a second, and we glossed over this fairly quickly last time, Rabbi Yosef Karo almost says it himself. At the end of his introduction to the Beis Yosef, he says, I just want to let you know, kind of parenthetically, why I called the book the Beis Yosef. And again, his name is Yosef. And he says in source number 13 in the bold, Nimtza, Shesefer ze mazon lekulabe. The idea is that my book will be a form of sustenance, a form of halachic sustenance, theological sustenance, spiritual sustenance for anyone who wants to partake of it. Alkein Karativ Beis Yosef. That's why I call it Beis Yosef. Why? What's the connection? Ki kishem shemi Beis Yosef hayu nizonim hakol mazon haguf, kach yu nizonim is sefer ze mazon hanefesh. It goes back to the biblical Joseph. Okay, what did the biblical Joseph do? The biblical Joseph created storehouses of grain that sustained and supported who? Not just the people in his city, not just the people in his family, not just the people even in his country, but the entire region, right, as far as anyone could see or reach, came to the storehouses of Joseph to be nourished, to be fed, to be sustained. And so Rabbi Yosef Karo almost like tips his hand. I don't think it's unintended, it wasn't a secret, but it's coded in these words of the last paragraph of his Beis Yosef, which is to say, my hope, my dream, my aspiration is that the same way Yosef's storehouses supported not just people on a local level, but people on a transnational global level, to the extent you could use that anachronistic formulation in ancient Egypt. So I have the same intention in 16th century Safed, not just to be a source of spiritual nourishment for my community, or even for my country, but for every Jew over the course of the entire globe, wherever that Jew may be.
And but we call him the Mechaber, don't we? Not the Maran. Why Mechaber and not Maran?
Yeah, so I'll talk about that in a second. Mechaber and Maran, happy to come back to that question, but I'll just conclude with these two last points. So last week I mentioned just in passing that Rabbi Yosef Karo was enmeshed in a smicha controversy. There was this ambition to restore the notion of smicha, to bring back a Sanhedrin. And it never really took off, and there was too much opposition. Rabbi Yosef Karo wasn't just comfortable with it. He seemed to be perfectly supportive of it. And it would all be of a piece. Which is to say, if the goal is to radiate out the authoritative final word about the halachic process, there is no better way to accomplish that goal than to create in Israel the authority of a Sanhedrin. Right? That is what the Sanhedrin, it's the Supreme Court. It is the final word. This is a debate on the law. It goes up to the Sanhedrin paskins, and that's it. It ends the debate. That becomes the final word. And Rabbi Yosef Karo saw himself as being part of that process to create a source of authority for the entirety of the Jewish world with respect to the halachic process. Conclude with a quote from Professor Tzvi Reblowski, who wrote one of the early attempts at biography of Rabbi Yosef Karo. And Tzvi Reblowski puts it this way: the last source you have on your source sheet, the social impact of the Shulchan Aruch was unprecedented. Its reception by Jews everywhere meant that for all ordinary purposes, one and the same manual was the de facto standard of reference. Even more, the Shulchan Aruch came to represent the summa of Jewish life. It was the valid formulation of practical Judaism that henceforth dominated Israel. Few literary documents apart from the Bible, the Talmud, and perhaps the prayer book have acquired such immense practical and symbolic social value in Jewish history. It's quite the formulation, but I think actually it's not overstated. I would challenge you to find a yeshiva, a Jewish school, a shul that doesn't have a copy of Rabbi Yosef Karo's Shulchan Aruch. I would challenge you to find a smicha curriculum that doesn't include the Shulchan Aruch. Right? It is indispensable to the halachic conversation, to the halachic decision-making process. Again, we still have to answer the question of how that happened and perhaps what enabled that to happen, but that it did happen to a large extent. And it shook out almost the way that Rabbi Yosef Karo hoped and expected is really almost incontrovertible. So please God, next week we'll pick up at this same time with a conversation about Rav Moshe Isserles, his halachic contributions to this discussion. And then in 2 weeks, we'll wrap things up and try to answer some of these larger questions as to how the Shulchan Aruch became such an authoritative code of Jewish law for the Jewish people. So I think I'll just pause now to answer some questions. I guess I'll begin with the questions from the chat, and then I'm happy to open it up for some discussion. Kids should learn it at home or at school. So I don't think Rabbi Yosef Karo necessarily differentiated. I think he would have been happy to know that children were learning his text at school, at home, or both. Moshe Feinstein.
So wait a minute. So that begs the question, did any school incorporate it into their curriculum? Any yeshiva or cheder incorporated into their curriculum, and when?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that question. We happen to have very little information until much later, until maybe the 18th century or even later, about yeshiva curricula. So hard to know who and where the Shulchan Aruch was being studied, other than at the top levels. So a posek is quoting the Shulchan Aruch, so we know that that they were using it. If it's not being used in a halachic conversation that gets recorded, we don't have a great record.
You said you were going to answer the question about Maran and Mechaber, and you didn't.
Yes, so happy to entertain Maran and Mechaber. We'll actually come back to what the secret meaning of Maran might be in 2 weeks. So I'll leave that as a means by which to whet your appetite. But the fact that he's known as Mechaber, which just means the author, the writer, the compiler, so that just speaks to the sense of his superiority and his kind of unmatched nature, right? Like calling someone the Rav. There are many Rabbanim, there are many Mechabrim. To call someone, the Mechaber, again, just amplifies the extent to which his project was successful, the extent to which he was accepted as being decisive. Do you believe that Moshe Feinstein learned all Shas every 30 days? And if you do, do you think he was inspired by what Kara wrote in the introduction to his Shulchan Aruch? So I don't know the answer to that question either. It is said that Rav Moshe Feinstein learned Shas many, many times, and that he completed it, every week or every year, on some kind of superhuman way. So I don't know if it came from this formulation in the Shulchan Aruch, but yes, it certainly reminds you of people who function this way and are able to create a repeating loop of chazara to learn these texts on such a frequent basis. Sorry about the audio issues. How would other communities hear of this work, and how would they obtain a copy? So that is a great question. The answer depends again kind of when and where. But at various points, over the course of many hundreds of years, there were travelers. There were travelers between and among various communities, particularly people collecting money for the Jews of Palestine, who were often in a indigent state. And they created crisscrossing networks of communication. Books and texts would be exchanged between and among communities. Some communities, this is a little later, but some communities imported books. They knew that there was a printing press in XYZ community. And they said, well, that's a source of scholarship for us. We want to know what's being published. And so we'll order the books. And right, and you get to a little later period, 17th, 18th century, you have book fairs in major European metropolises. And books could be exchanged that way. So the answer is sort of all of the above in the sense of, you know, how communication happened in a pre-modern world. It tends to be a little more haphazard, but probably more often than we think, there was an exchange of texts and ideas. Okay, yes, so I do Tamizrach, Romaniot. So, you know, this is part of what I mean when I speak about Italian Jewry, Greek Jewry, and to not think in such a binary fashion as the world being divided just between Ashkenazim and Sfard. Okay, doesn't Barry Levy contend that some Torah scribes amended the Torah to conform to the Zohar? So I am not familiar with that.
It's in his book, Fixing God's Torah,
okay,
where he says that when there was a pill pool in the Zohar, which was obviously a different text than the Torah had, that they assumed that the Torah was incorrect and the Zohar was correct, and so they amended it. Just like we have with Rashi sometimes, it's obviously the Girsa of the Torah that Rashi had is not the text we have today, but nobody amended it to conform to Rashi's pill pool or drush or whatever. But there were scribes who amended it to conform to the Zohar. Like I said, it's in his book, Fixing God's Torah, where okay, he gives examples.
Okay.
And he is a YU guy and all that, so.
Okay, I'll have to look into that. True, Venice was a center of printing in Europe. Although travel is certainly difficult, 16th century, there was still a lot of travel, absolutely. Joseph had a mandate given to him by Paro. Who gave Rabbi Yosef Karo the mandate? So that's really the point, is Rabbi Yosef Karo was a, self-appointed. You know, how does anyone get invested with authority? That's a big question. Beyond the scope of this conversation, but by the point in time when Rabbi Yosef Karo was publishing his books, he had already acquired quite a reputation as being one of, if not the foremost scholar in his generation. So, did the why between the Rambam and Karo reflect how they viewed Messianic times and times of redemption? So, I'm not sure I understand that question.
The differences in their scope of what they covered, including the sacrifices or not, was that because of how they viewed when ideal times would come, that one would say that the temple only came at the end, at the end, at the end? Or did it reflect that, no, it would come near the beginning of redemption and you'd have hundreds of years of a temple again? So did it have anything to do with their eschatology?
Good question. I don't think we have enough information to know the answer to that question. Are there any conflicts of decision between the Beis Yosef and the Shulchan Aruch? So the answer is none that I know of offhand. Meaning I don't think you'll find a case where the Beis Yosef writes at the end of a paragraph, the conclusion is X, and then you see the Shulchan Aruch and the conclusion is Y. There may be times where there's some ambiguity in the Beis Yosef, and then the Shulchan Aruch clarifies something later. I'm not sure if there are any cases that we know of where he rethought it or retracted. I don't know of any offhand. Unlike the Shulchan Aruch, does the Beis Yosef attempt to teach us how to decide future questions? So the answer is there's not any daylight between the two in the sense of how to go about the halachic decision-making process. The Shulchan Aruch relies on the fact that you've studied the Beis Yosef and you know the three pillars and you know the next tier and you know the tier after that. So it's all working within one unified, coherent system. Okay. I think there may be one or two more comments here. Why doesn't the Shulchan Aruch include laws dealing with mechitza? Why doesn't the Shulchan Aruch include laws dealing with mechitza? So that's a fair question. I think the answer is probably sociological, which was the architecture or the orientation of the synagogues at the time didn't require it. Which is to say, if the women are in another room or if the women are on another level, so, you know, there's not a specific need to, you know, say how high the wall has to be or how thick the separation, whatever the case may be. I mean, Rabbi Yosef Karo couldn't anticipate every issue that, you know, that would come up. Because the world changes or technology changes or sociology changes, you know, which means that for all his authoritativeness, the halachic conversation is still open, right? In many senses. Okay. And let me just see. I think we've come to the end of the chat. Any questions that are unanswered or anything that is still on the minds of anyone? Still here.
With regard to the mechitza, I just asked that question. I mean, even in his day, there still have to be standards in terms of what a mechitza looked like. Granted that maybe that they were in separate rooms or whatever, but you see, even back from the times of the Gemara, they talked about the frivolity of having women and women together and how they separate them in the Zohar, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? So it's not like it wasn't known in those times. So I'm just wondering. Because it caused a lot of controversy back in the 60s, which you remember back then, it was before your time. There's a big, I call them mechitza wars among the conservative and Orthodox. There's a big thing with Rav Soloveitchik in terms of how high mechitza could be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there is no written halakha in the Shulchan Aruch, which always bothered me because, like, it's not like you can go back in the times of the Gemara and you can see that there was the thing of a mechitza. So I find it odd that this would be left out.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say something more general, which is that, you know, any comprehensive code is never going to be perfectly comprehensive, right? There's always going to be, you know, pockets, issues. At the end of the day, the Shulchan Aruch was structured along the lines of the tour. So, you know, to the extent that, you know, the tour gave pride of place to particular issues, those ended up getting you know, more attention in the Shulchan Aruch. Have there been any attempts to update the Shulchan Aruch by adding halacha dealing with things like when does an astronaut circling the Earth consider Shabbos to have begun? So the answer is yes, there's 500 years worth of halachic writing. We'll talk a little bit about it in 2 weeks. But the Shulchan Aruch spawned a whole cottage industry, right? Of commentaries and super commentaries and new commentaries and new books. Right, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote a new Shulchan Aruch. He called it the Shulchan Aruch Harav. It was a Shulchan Aruch for his Hasidim. Right, with based on the Shulchan Aruch, but with new laws and a new approach to law. So yes, on the one hand, right, I want to just amplify this point that the Shulchan Aruch was successful in that it became an authoritative code of Jewish law. But I want to just be careful to say the Shulchan Aruch didn't fix law for all time, such that there was no further conversation. Ironically, in many ways, the Shulchan Aruch created and generated, right, much more halachic conversation.
Is it comparable to Rambam's Rambam, doesn't it?
I'm sorry, say that again.
That makes it, the fact that it generated more conversation makes it comparable to the halachot created by the Rambam.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So I'm happy to stay on, but if there aren't any further questions, I want to take this opportunity to thank Tari Motion and all the wonderful people who make this possible for the opportunity to do a little teaching. And I look forward to continuing next week.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, everyone, for being here.
Appreciate it. See
you next week.
Thank you very much. Forward.
Just one minor pronunciation name. Veblovsky is the pronunciation of Tzvi, not Veblovsky.
Ah, okay. Thank you.
Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.